Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Let's talk about fast food now, and admit it, I bet you have a jingle in your head right now. Because according to a new book, on any given day in America, an estimated one-third of all American adults is eating something at a fast food restaurant. But fast food doesn't mean the same thing to everyone everywhere. For some, owning a franchise has been a path to wealth. But fast food restaurants are hyper-concentrated in some of the country's lowest income and most segregated areas. And according to the Centers for Disease Control, African Americans are more likely to eat fast food than any other racial group, which is why fast food is also seen as the culprit for high rates of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease among black people. So how did that happen? And is fast food hero or villain in black America? In her new book, Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America, historian Marcia Chatelain traces what she calls the hidden history of the relationship between the struggle for civil rights and the expansion of the fast food industry. And Marcia Chatelain is with us now. She's a professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University, and she was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
You know, it's so interesting that you chose McDonald's, because McDonald's really is everywhere. And I mean, it's even here because, you know, I think many people know that the estate of Joan Kroc, the widow of McDonald's Corporation founder Ray Kroc, is among NPR's financial supporters. I mean, her gift was made a huge difference in the life of this corporation. So, I mean, it is literally everywhere. So I have to ask, you know, why McDonald's? What made you turn your scholarly attention to it?
Well, growing up in Chicago, the presence of African-American franchise owners was everywhere in my life. And I remember every time I would go to a museum or a cultural site, I would see these signs that said, you know, paid for by the Black McDonald's Operators Association of Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana. And I thought to myself, what does it mean for this group of people to have facilitated my first contact with African-American history? And what did it mean for so much of Black life to be underwritten by franchise owners? And so this book really explores the relationship between Black America and McDonald's to help us understand where other parts of our society has failed. McDonald's has unfortunately had to pick up the slack.
So in a way, it was like hiding in plain sight, right? I mean, you never worked at McDonald's.
I didn't, but boy, did I eat it. I have eaten almost, I think, at every McDonald's in Black America. I remember all of the ephemera that was created around the Martin Luther King holiday that was paid for by Black franchise owners. I remember the Bud Billiken Parade, a huge part of Chicago's back-to-school celebration, and a lot of Black franchise owners being at the helm of that event.
So Ray Kroc was not exactly some big racial liberal. I mean, how did it happen that McDonald's became so important on the franchise side? In fact, the first Black-owned franchise was, in fact, in Chicago, right?
Absolutely. So Ray Kroc was not a racial progressive, but what he was a person who was very much committed to the expansion of McDonald's. And while he initially concentrated on expansion in the suburbs, after the uprisings that followed Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, the business community saw an opportunity because there were deep demands for more commerce. The federal government was underwriting minority business initiatives that supported the growth of franchises. And even more importantly, the civil rights establishment started to pivot towards Black capitalism as its priority. And those forces all came together to bring McDonald's to Black America.
So you tell some very interesting stories about this first Black franchise owner, Herman Petty. He was an innovator in his own right. For example, you say there are so many interesting stories in your book. I mean, we just don't have time to explore them all. But, you know, you pointed out that, for example, some of the early owners didn't want women working in the stores because they thought they were a distraction. And he was one of the first people to bring women back into the stores. But also, he was a military guy, and the kind of the mechanistic work style was very familiar to him, right?
Absolutely. Herman Petty represents, I think, a lot of the men who were early in African-American franchising. They were these men who had opportunities through military. Some of them were college educated, but they all had to contend with the roadblock of discriminatory lending practices, so it was hard to get bank loans. They wanted to create businesses in their community and see opportunities, and they also trusted Black women to be able to execute and really do the hard work in the stores. And so while women had been kind of banished from McDonald's after the McDonald's brothers really wanted to focus on mechanization and thought they were flirting and they would be too much of a distraction, what Herman Petty understood was that these jobs were ideal places for Black women who were trusted in the community and who could deliver on the incredibly demanding needs of a McDonald's franchise.
But you also point out that these stores were hugely profitable.
Yes, they were.
I mean, you say in the book that Black stores, as they were they really called Black stores?
They called them Black stores. Different time.
Okay. That Black stores, as they were called, on average, gross 25% more profits than white stores. I would think then these people should have been heroes within the organization, right?
Well, I think their value was noted, but being valued doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be respected. And so one of the reasons why African Americans outperformed in this system is that they had a more captive market, they had less competitors, and during the oil embargoes in the 1970s, they had a consumer base that was more likely to walk or use public transportation to go to restaurants, while folks in the suburbs were not going to use precious oil to drive and get a Big Mac.
This is so fascinating. So on the one hand, it's been a symbiotic relationship, right? I mean, these franchises offered opportunities. It offered a dignified experience. I mean, one of the things you pointed out, in fact, you opened the book with McDonald's in Ferguson, Missouri, where people would go when a lot of the other businesses were not open, wouldn't open. And other people have written about the fact that in some communities, McDonald's is the only place you can sit down and have a meal.
Or Wi-Fi.
Or
coffee when you're a senior citizen in the morning.
It's a gathering place for a lot of people. On the other hand, you point out that some of the same kind of racial dynamics that affect all other areas of American life have been present here. So I'm going to ask you, Professor Catlin,
yes.
Has McDonald's been a net negative or net positive in the African American community?
And I'm going to answer this way. McDonald's provides us a prism for wondering, why does a McDonald's have to have such an important role in certain communities? And in others, it can just be a place to eat. I think that for African Americans who chose franchising as the path forward, it's very easy for us to belittle them. But we know how the story ended of the 1960s and the 1970s. I think what McDonald's has provided is an opportunity for some, but at the expense of far too many. And at the end of the day—
And why do you say that? The expense in terms of what? The health effects?
Not just the health effects. I think any time we have communities that have to rely on a business to be the place of refuge, to be the place for Wi-Fi, to be the sponsor of youth sports, to be the place where the youth job program happens, for the college scholarships to emanate from, then we have a problem.
How is the current political environment affecting the Black franchise owners at McDonald's? Because as we know, there is a lot of interest in the health effects, the negative health effects of eating fast food. And there's been a lot of reporting on this, even in the Black community and Black-oriented media outlets. You know, on the other hand, there is still a lot of interest in Black capitalism. I mean, you see some of the, you know, prominent figures like, let's say, Jay-Z and Beyonce. Mm-hmm. You know, the interest in them is equally their business practices as well as their artistic output, right? So how is this current focus affecting Black franchise owners? Do you know?
I think it's really complicated because they're living in an age where there's more competition just in terms of food to eat. I think the category of fast casual has complicated this because often that food is marketed as healthier, even if it's not, so that the space is larger. Some of them are contending with the consequences of gentrification in the neighborhoods that they first started in. And so in addition to those issues, we are in another cycle in which Black franchise owners are having a lot of problems with McDonald's and feeling that they're being advocated for. So that cycle of tension continues. But I think that part of the critique of the quality of the food has led the Black franchise community to do more health initiatives. So in this very strange way, they are both the problem, but then they're trying to offer the solution with free health screenings or initiatives that promote, you know, making broader choices or eating the healthier items off the menu. But again, it's always a conundrum when you have a corporation, I think, in the position to dictate so many different directions in people's lives.
That is Marcia Chatelain. She is a professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University. Her latest book, Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America, is out now. Professor Chatelain, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place.
Bob Vollmer is about to retire. He's been a surveyor for the Department of Natural Resources in Indiana, locating boundary lines and collecting information for nearly 60 years. He got a late start after he got his engineering degree from Purdue and after he served in World War II. Bob Vollmer is 102 years old. He is the oldest state employee in Indiana history. He joins us from Indianapolis. Mr. Vollmer, what an honor it is to talk to you, sir.
Well, it's an honor to be able to talk to you. I mean, when you get up to my age, well, your time is almost numbered.
You're 102. Why are you retiring? Or are you just going to go on to another job?
No, I'm going to. I have a lot of things I'm going to do. Like, say, your body tells you, and I don't think I can justify what I used to do. I mean, tangled in vines, poison ivy, all kind of things that you really have to be careful with, you know. Yeah. I've got a lot of things planned.
Like what?
Well, I have some great grandkids coming along. Matter of fact, if I can live a little bit longer, I might be a great, great grandfather. I don't know, but I've got some projects I want to build for these kids, and then I want to go back to the South Pacific again to visit some of the cemeteries, and might build me a new swimming pool or something like that.
Build yourself a new swimming pool?
That's
a lot of hard work.
You got it, but all the new equipment now a guy can do that pretty easy.
I'm told you're not the oldest person in your family.
Well, my mother went to 108.
My mother, who was 20 years younger than you when she died, once told me the hardest thing about growing older was to lose so many of your friends.
Well, that's kind of hits the spot here pretty good, too. I think about that a lot. All the fellows, all the people I went to school with, there's none of them left. I wonder why I should be the only one left. And I'm still around. Yeah, I can appreciate what she said, because there's times I think the same thing.
Did you lose friends in the war?
Yes, absolutely. First, I'm thinking about my brother. He was killed on the Tarawa jail there in the South Pacific. The Tarawa invasion was a bad one. We lost a lot of men there. But I lucked out. Matter of fact, I've lucked out all my life. I've had people that's done a lot of big favors for me. Some people I don't have no idea who they were. I wouldn't know how I could repay them, but I do think about them a lot. There's no question about that, but I think about them an awful lot.
You know, if I might, I think you repay everybody by just being the kind of person that you are. I'm glad I've lived long enough to meet you.
Yeah, well, I try to I try to be right with people. I have four great-grandchildren. Makes me feel pretty old, but we're kind of keeping the family intact. It's just a good, solid family. And no matter how many grandchildren we have, they're all together. I can look at that as say, well, that's one of the proud things of my life.
Bob Vollmer, a surveyor with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Other folks talking about, save me. Wasn't nothing wrong with slavery. At least we got good food back then.
One reason we know so much about the Underground Railroad is the work of a man named William Still. He was a free black man in Philadelphia who helped nearly 800 enslaved people escape to freedom in the years before the Civil War. And he interviewed them. He wrote down accounts of their journeys, eventually publishing them all in a book called The Underground Railroad. Now a new album pays tribute to Still's work by setting some of those stories to music. NPR's Tom Heisinger has been listening.
It's about time William Still was widely recognized for his efforts as an abolitionist, historian, and conductor on the Underground Railroad. He's featured prominently in the new film Harriet, and now Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Paul Moravec has written Sanctuary Road, an oratorio based on Still's 1872 book called The Underground Railroad. Bass baritone Deshaun Burton sings the role of William Still, who was born free in New Jersey in 1821. He moved to Philadelphia in his 20s, working for an abolitionist society, helping to guide enslaved fugitives to freedom. He wrote down everything, and the stories he documented were terrifying and heartbreaking. Consider Ellen Craft, sung by Rayanne Bryce Davis. Craft disguised herself as a white man. An ailing slave owner headed to Philadelphia with her enslaved valet, who was, in fact, her fiancé.
They see me as a sick white gentleman, a sick white gentleman, who has his own money, a black man who sits with the others.
Moravec's music for Sanctuary Road doesn't push any envelopes. Its sweeping lyricism sounds solidly American, a comfortable fit with the libretto crafted by Mark Campbell, drawn from Still's book. Another harrowing tale belongs to the resourceful Henry Box Brown, who mailed himself in a crate from Richmond to Philadelphia, breathing through a hole the size of a nickel.
It took me 26 hours since I had myself nailed in a shipping crate. It took me 26 hours of being thrown this way and that, of not seeing the light of day.
Sanctuary Road is not without a few flashes of humor. Before he climbed into his shipping crate, Brown, sung here by Malcolm J. Merriweather, wrote on the top, this side up.
Now if only these fools could read.
Apparently, Brown spent part of his treacherous journey upside down. The danger in these journeys is depicted by three frenzied chase scenes. Sanctuary Road also contains a chorus, which both comments on the action and participates in it. Here, the Oratorio Society of New York cries out as slaveholders, offering rewards for runaways. Americans still have a lot to learn about the Underground Railroad. We can't know the hell slavery was firsthand. But in a piece like Sanctuary Road, we can learn about William Still, an important figure in our history, and the hundreds he ushered into freedom.
The album is Sanctuary Road. Our reviewer is NPR's Tom Heisinger.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation.
This week marked the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the largest Nazi death camp where more than a million men, women and children were murdered during the Second World War. Dozens of world leaders attended a special ceremony at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the official World Holocaust Memorial. But it's not just politicians and world leaders who are marking the anniversary. Here in Britain, one of England's most prominent Premier League football clubs, Chelsea, has commissioned the giant mural and invited the team's supporters to say no to any form of religious or racial discrimination. The BBC's religion editor Martin Bashir has been given special access to the club, and here's his report.
A safety harness used on construction sites is clipped into position. Final checks completed, the hydraulic crane creeps up one of the high exterior walls at Chelsea Football Club. But they're not refurbishing the stadium. Instead, an artist is making a statement.
At this time, it's very, very crucial for us to not forget the stories of the past.
Solomon Sousa, of British Israeli descent, has been commissioned to paint a giant mural, 40 by 23 feet, in memory of those who perished in the Holocaust.
So many people fell victim to the hatred, you know, and burned in the fires of Auschwitz.
As you arrive at the ground off the Fulham Road in southwest London, the mural covers the entire wall that greets supporters. Three distinctive characters are instantly visible. And as you get closer, it becomes clear that they are footballers.
Ron Jones was a British POW. He was captured in Benghazi and ended up in a sub-camp in Auschwitz for prisoners of war.
Jones survived the death camp. The others did not.
We have Arpad Wise. He was a Hungarian footballer, then turned manager and coach. He was a celebrated footballer, and he ended up also burning in the fires of Auschwitz, along with Julius Hirsch, who was one of the saddest of this, because he was actually a German Jew. He'd actually bled for Germany in World War I. He was a decorated soldier, fought for 4 years, and was a highly celebrated footballer. He was a very, very powerful striker, and all that didn't matter in the end. He ended up being sent off to the gas chambers as well.
Well, then there might be an announcement to come over the public address system inside the stadium, and whether a racist comment is perhaps being heard by the players out there, because...
Although the sport condemns any form of discrimination, some paying customers continue to use football stadiums as the forum to express their racial hatred.
So there we are. There is an announcement now over the loudspeaker to warn the crowd that there must be no further racist behaviour. Kante is going to shoot from...
And so the National Holocaust Museum has compiled a short video to mark the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Between harrowing images of the death camps, male and female players describe the danger of being silent in the face of hatred. The film begins with Frank Lampard, the Chelsea manager.
Today, on Holocaust Memorial Day, we must remember.
We must stand by.
We need to stand up.
And we need to stand together.
But what of the players themselves?
Jack Bennett's just going to work into the pink.
Here at the Chelsea training ground, under frowning skies and persistent rain, the team's doing its best to smile through the training. Captain Cesar Azpilicueta says the club has created a programme to tackle racial hatred, taking players and supporters to Auschwitz and commissioning the giant mural.
We are very aware and very involved in all the campaigns and trying to help as much as we can, and that's part of the job, and I think we have to keep going in this direction, because step by step I hope to eradicate it as soon as possible.
But as the captain of Chelsea, when some of your playing colleagues are subjected to this kind of hatred, What do you feel about that?
I feel bad and I feel sad to see this happening. Obviously, they are my teammates and we share every day, and to have this kind of discrimination is very sad. But it means that the problem is there, and not only the footballers, but everybody in the street can face that kind of discrimination.
Back at Stamford Bridge, the mural is now complete. A vivid call to arms against a form of hatred that still bedevils the game and society at large.
Martin Bashir.
And some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Yeah. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers?
Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, on which the country celebrates the life and the legacy of one of the giants of the civil rights movement. While Dr. King is greatly admired today, he faced hatred and mistrust in his time, including from U.S. intelligence agencies. In 1963, the FBI wrote in a memo that Dr. King was, quote, dangerous and should be, quote, marked by the agency. Years of surveillance followed, with the FBI even sending Dr. King a threatening letter, apparently urging him to commit suicide. Dr. King's surveillance wasn't unique. For years, black activists had been tracked, infiltrated, and even targeted by the U.S. government, activists including Ida B. Wells, Ella Baker, and Fred Hampton. Today, this surveillance continues. In response to the Black Lives Matter movement, law enforcement stepped up its surveillance of black activists. And in 2017, 6 months into the Trump administration, the FBI circulated a secret report warning of so-called black identity extremism. Although that specific FBI designation has changed under public pressure, advocates are still worried its replacement still leads to the targeted surveillance of black activists. So here to help us break us down, all of this down, is Malkia Debitch-Cyril, founder and senior fellow at Media Justice. Malkia, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go through some history here. What did the surveillance of civil rights leaders look like in the 1960s and 70s?
Well, like you described, I mean, we had the counterintelligence program of the FBI. It started around 1956, and some say it was ended in 1971, but it wasn't ended as much as it was found out by a team of white activists that broke into some FBI offices and stole the papers, then known as the COINTELPRO papers, that outed the program. We're talking about a long history of covert operations against domestic political groups, using methods at the time, such as wiretaps, discrediting, falsifying information, reading and sending mail falsely, setting up conflicts both between activists and between activists and police, often that ended up either with somebody dead or somebody in prison for the rest of their lives, false arrests, and other kinds of infiltration.
So how did the FBI and law enforcement rationalize the surveillance?
Well, you know, surveillance historically has been intended to monitor dissidents and police race. So they rationalized it by claiming, one, that the rise of a quote-unquote black messiah, that was J. Edgar Hoover's words, would threaten the national security of the United States. In fact, political dissidents, whether you're talking about the American Indian movement, you're talking about environmental activists or others, has always been framed as a threat to national security. But that's only because national security has been framed as protecting the interests of white supremacy.
Moving up to what we're seeing today, what do we know so far about the, quote, black identity extremism label from the FBI report?
The title has changed, and now they kind of just talk about identity extremists. But, you know, part of the problem with that terminology is that it both focuses on black activists while actually denying or preventing any focus on white nationalists who are actually responsible for something like 80% of domestic terrorism in the United States. There's been some, you know, FOIAs done both by Media Justice and the ACLU, Color of Change, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and others. They found, you know, a few things. They found out, for example, the FBI was able to alert officials about a protester's plans to travel from New York to Ferguson for a protest on Thanksgiving Day a couple years ago. And the question is, you know, how did they know that? You know, what techniques have they been using to monitor black activists? And one of the problems is that we don't know, right? So that's why the FOIAs are so important, and those are Freedom of Information Act requests to find out more about how this designation is affecting the surveillance of Black activists.
So have there been people arrested, or have there been any other tangible consequences of the surveillance, to your knowledge?
Well, we know that one young man his name Rakim Balogun was arrested in Texas. He's the first, you know, publicly known activist to be arrested under that designation. He was arrested, you know, on a gun charge, on a gun possession charge. But how they came to know he had a gun in his home, you know, begs the question. You know, he was arrested. When he was arrested, they also removed reading material from his home, you know, reading material that would be considered, you know, radical. That is not unprecedented, but it is unusual. So, you know, so we have that arrest that we know for a fact was made under that designation. And then we have plenty of other arrests of Black activists that were improper. The fact is, though, that these programs like counterintelligence program in the 60s are done in secret. And so we know very little about how they operate. That's part of the need to investigate.
What are Black activists doing today in order to protect themselves from this sort of surveillance?
Oh, well, you know, first of all, we understand that there's no sense of real safety. That's not really possible, particularly given the technology of the day. What folks are doing is they are, you know, turning off their geolocation on their phones when they protest. We're becoming aware of the use of Stingray devices and protecting our phones in the ways that we can. Stingray cell site interceptors, which, you know, monitor wide swaths of cell phone use, you know, making very, you know, but the fact is, at the end of the day, the most secure community is an organized community. At the end of the day, there's very little that we can do technically to protect ourselves, but there's a lot we can do in terms of our behavior and how we organize and how we build relationships with one another. And that's kind of where we've seen the most focus and improvement.
And Malkia, real quick, do you think that these this knowledge about surveillance has kept people away, or is it actually driving recruitment to organizations that fight for, you know, Black rights?
You know, this isn't just about surveillance. It's about the fact that digital technologies have been used to increase the policing and imprisonment of Black people, and that is driving recruitment like never before.
Malkia Debbich-Cyril is the founder and executive director of the Center for Media Justice. Malkia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This is my rifle.
This morning, thousands of gun rights activists are gathering in Richmond, Virginia, for a rally in support of the Second Amendment. This rally is an annual event. It's part of a Virginia tradition known as Lobby Day. This year, though, authorities are getting ready for the possibility of violence. The governor has even declared a state of emergency. NPR's Hannah Alam is in Richmond, and she's with me now. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning.
Where are you, and what have you been seeing this morning?
Well, right now, I'm a block from the rally site. I'm actually in a building that's overlooking the Capitol. And so you can see down below this huge crush of people. I've actually just come from down there from the crowd. And yeah, it's just, you know, guns everywhere, long guns, handguns, body armor, Civil War uniforms, revolutionary costumes. I interviewed one guy, asked for his name, and he said, George Washington. Hmm. So, you know, it's a really big and colorful crowd out there. One guy had a big banner, pro-Second Amendment banner, and he was, you know, walking around getting autographs from all the people to show kind of, you know, the diversity of where people have come from for this event. In addition to several states, he had autographs from Liverpool, England, and Iceland.
This rally is an annual event. It happens every year. And yet this year, something is different. The authorities were worried enough to declare a state of emergency. What are they so concerned about?
We don't know exactly the nature of the threat that led to the state of emergency, but we do know that there were lots of groups making noise about coming, and these are groups that are of concern to law enforcement. They range from some of the more militant militia groups to white nationalist groups and some militant leftists.
And Hannah, I know that you went to a private event last night, a private militia event. Let's take a listen to some of your reporting.
And good evening, everybody, and welcome to the State of the Militia 2020. This will be our first, not our last.
At a rural lodge half an hour outside of Richmond, 75 or so militia members are gathering on the eve of the gun rights rally downtown. They're eating corned beef and cabbage at banquet tables. Pretty much everyone in the room is armed. The centerpieces are glass jars filled with red carnations, American flags, and ammunition.
I think it's cute. It kind of describes freedom in the most simplest way, right?
That's Tammy Lee. She's one of the organizers of the State of the Militia event. She warns that not everybody is happy that a few journalists have shown up. In fact, she doesn't really want us here.
I don't really like reporters, to be honest with you. So it's hard to allow me to have you guys here, to be honest.
But letting outsiders into an intimate event like this, they decided, is the only way to fight what they call the distortion of their movement. Yes, most of the people here are committed to armed rebellion if the government tries to take their guns. No, they say, they aren't white supremacists or bigots.
We're now moving toward what we call the American movement, which is neutral people, constitutionalists, you know, people who don't hate. They welcome all sexes and races and creeds and religions and you know, so that's part of what we're doing here tonight, but that's what we're doing out in public, and that's what we're doing out at these events now.
One of the speakers, John Cody, head of the South Carolina Lightfoot Militia, brought dozens of members to Richmond. Some of them were also in Charlottesville in 2017. Cody said his group learned hard lessons from that deadly weekend.
I think the whole, the narrative and the perspective has changed a little bit. Charlottesville was more of a white supremacist or whatever that were there. This is about the Constitution, about people's constitutional rights.
The mood at the gathering is festive, but there's an undercurrent of tension. Maybe the rally will go off without a hitch and all the fears will be for nothing. But Tammy Lee knows there are instigators, both on the right and the left, she says, who want to mess up the day for everybody.
We're all dreading it here. These men will, maybe they'll tell you, maybe they won't, but we're all very anxious and we're dreading it because we know what, we've been to these rallies, we see what happens. So I don't think our message will really get out there.
Okay, so that woman sounds very, very anxious. We have heard a lot about fear over this tense situation. What does the security presence look like there today?
There is a huge security presence here. There are barricades, security fence, metal detector to get onto the grounds. And they've blocked several roads to prevent, you know, cars from coming. And that brings to mind, you know, the violence that we saw in Charlottesville in 2017. And that's exactly what they're trying to avoid today.
Okay, a lot of precautionary measures. NPR's Hannah Lam in Richmond, Virginia. Hannah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I've never seen this before. I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
In Portland, Oregon, jury selection is underway in the trial of a man who prosecutors say went on a stabbing rampage on a light rail train in 2017. The man, Jeremy Christian, is charged with murder. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson has the story and a warning. This story does contain some disturbing and offensive language.
On the day before the stabbings, Jeremy Christian was ranting while he rode a Portland Max light rail train.
Oh, it's like we got a Christian or Muslim bus driver, I'll stab you too. Move forward.
The cell phone video was first reported by the Portland television station KATU. That same day, court documents allege Christian assaulted Demetria Hester. She was riding the light rail train on her way home from work and told Christian he was being offensive.
And he replied, "You do not have the right to even be on this train. I built this country. You don't have a right to speak. You're black. You don't have a right to be here."
Hester, who's black, says Christian, who's white, was also shouting profanity and threatening her. At a news conference months after the attack, Hester said Christian lunged at her and hit her in the eye.
"And I grabbed my mace and sprayed him in the face with mace."
Police arrived, but Christian slipped away. The next day, court documents say Christian was on a similar rant. This time it appeared to be directed at two young African-American women on the light rail train. One was wearing a hijab. There was shouting, shoving. The situation escalated. Court documents say Christian pulled a folding knife out of his pocket and stabbed three men. Only one of the men survived. Prosecutors charged Christian with two counts of murder in the first degree and one count of attempted murder, as well as assault and intimidation. In court, Christian has denied any wrongdoing.
Not guilty of anything but defending myself.
But there's video of the attacks and multiple witnesses.
Even if your evidence seems very good, you still have to be very careful.
Katie Suver is the deputy district attorney in Marion County, Oregon. She's not involved in Christian's trial, but supervises her office's major criminal cases, like murder.
Even if your evidence seems really good, the defendant can still raise all possible defenses, particularly as it relates to the mental state to commit a crime.
Records from Christian's previous arrests and interviews with people who knew him since childhood indicate his mental health was clearly declining for years leading up to the attacks.
The law places a great deal of focus on the why question.
Jeffrey Ellis is an attorney and co-director of the Oregon Capital Resource Center. He's not involved in Christian's defense, but says there are a lot of factors that can go into defending against intent, like negligence or diminished capacity.
In other words, you were suffering from a mental illness that was so severe that you weren't able to form the intent.
Even years later, for those in Portland who take public transit, the murders have had a lasting impact.
We were, like, scared. We literally couldn't believe it.
Ikra Raza is 18 years old. She takes public transportation to her Islamic high school in a Portland suburb.
We couldn't even put into words what had happened because we were like, there could have been any chance that would have been us.
Federal law enforcement officials say their investigation into the murders is still open and will make any charging decisions after the state's trial is done. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
There are a lot of barriers to mental health care in the United States. Insurance, cost, availability of therapists or psychiatrists, and on and on. For people of color, these barriers can be much higher. And there's something else in the way.
Fewer than 4% of licensed psychologists are actually people of color. So when you're looking specifically at psychologists who are able to provide mental health needs, the number is incredibly low.
That's Dr. Joy Harden Bradford. She's a licensed psychologist. And what she's saying there is that for people of color, especially Black would-be patients, it can be difficult or impossible to find a therapist who understands the experiences they bring to the table. And that can be a major deterrent to seeking care in the first place, as well as getting care that actually works. Takeaway host Tanzina Vega spoke with Dr. Joy and Imadi about the lack of Black therapists and what's keeping more people from getting into this line of work.
I think one of the main things is that it takes an incredibly long time. So you're looking at least 10 years of school plus additional training. And even after you have received your PhD or PsyD, you still have to do another 1 to 2 years of training under someone else's license before you can operate independently. So when you're looking at like finances and who really is able to be in a position to be able to do that much school and to, you know, support themselves and maybe a family even afterwards, you may be cutting off a lot of people who economically just could not be able to do something like that.
Dr. Joy, do you also find maybe that there is a cultural element, or at least there has been maybe in the past, a cultural element to not wanting to be involved in mental health services? I think, you know, I'm Latina. I know that in our own community, there has historically at least been some reluctance to getting involved either as a patient in this line of mental health. So do you think cultural issues play into it, or is it really just a question of access to education?
Well, I definitely think that there are some cultural issues when it comes to seeking services. I have found that far less in terms of people like wanting to be therapists. I think that there's actually a lot of interest, you know, in younger students I see who are interested in psychology and exploring it. But I do think the access to being in an educational program, and not to mention the educational programs themselves, are sometimes very difficult. So just like we think about the microaggressions that exist in any other workplace, sometimes there are a lot of microaggressions in graduate programs, so they are not always the most welcoming for students of color to even participate in.
Imadi, you started the online space Depressed While Black. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, originally, Depressed While Black started as my thesis at Columbia University for my nonfiction creative writing program. And I didn't know any other black person who was dealing with depression. And so it was a way for me to basically chronicle how I'm trying to survive and live dealing with clinical depression and chronic suicidal thoughts. But it was also a way to find out who else is out there and kind of try to create that sense of community.
How did that sense of community come about? Because it is very difficult, particularly in communities of color, to talk about this and to feel that there's, that you're safe talking about it. So how did you see the community begin to grow?
It's just the more that I shared my story on Twitter, on Facebook, on Tumblr, there were just more people just saying, me too, I'm going through this too. And in the beginning, the challenge that I experienced and the challenge that my community experienced was just kind of the silence or the apathy that some of our loved ones had when it comes to us asking for help. The first time that I told my mom that I'm going to therapy, she told me, did I pray about it? And I said, yes. And she said, you know, well, did you have your pastor pray about it? And I said, yes. And it was kind of a shock to her to realize that you can have a robust spiritual life and still deal with mental illness. And so a lot of us were trying to find people who were not demonizing our condition, who were not saying that our condition is the result of some sort of spiritual deficiency. But someone, we were looking for people that said, I feel it too, and that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with us.
Dr. Joy, do you find that in your practice with patients that you see, patients of color in particular, that faith or religion, which can sometimes be helpful, can also be a hindrance to people wanting to seek mental health care?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm really glad that Imadi shared that story, because I think that that is so many people's experiences, especially in talking with family members. And there has been a very common misconception that mental illness comes from a weakened faith relationship, or there's something that you're not doing, quote unquote, correctly in terms of your faith relationship, when, of course, we know that it is not connected to that at all, that people in all walks of faiths, independent of a spiritual practice, can struggle with mental illness.
Are there other things, Dr. Joy? We talked a little bit about faith here and somewhat about cultural issues. Are there other things that keep people of color from asking for mental health services?
Well, I think finances are another huge issue, you know, and coupled with finances, I think just the managed healthcare system is very difficult to navigate. And so, you know, if you are looking for a therapist who accepts your insurance, it may be difficult to find someone who is still accepting that insurance plan. And then if they're not, then cost can be an issue, because, you know, therapy ranges sometimes between $75 to $250 per session. So when you're looking at your budget for the month, it may come down to like, okay, can I afford to go to therapy, or can I afford to put food on the table? So I think finances and health insurance are another barrier to access.
Imadi, that's something that comes up a lot when I talk to just, you know, friends and people who have been trying to access health care, that increasingly mental health providers don't offer health insurance options. And it's even more difficult if you're looking for someone who takes insurance. When you finally went to a therapist, did you have that experience? What was it like for you?
It actually was a scary experience for me. At the beginning of me asking for help, I was on a Los Angeles highway speeding, wanting to die. And it kind of gave me a huge wake-up call that I needed to get help. And so I was a USC grad student at that time, and both of the counselors told me that I need to quit school and get a police escort to the hospital. So I wasn't really introduced to therapeutic services. I was basically introduced to a punitive system when it comes to me asking for help. And so I do want to note that that some black folks that are asking for help, we're not even getting to the therapeutic part of the mental health system. We're getting into the incarceration system. And so a lot of times we're getting filtered out of the services that we need the most. So I pretty much had to negotiate with these therapists and said, you know, I don't want to go back home, but I do want to get help. And eventually we settled on getting a therapist, because I couldn't afford outpatient therapy. So some of the challenge is the fact that we're getting funneled into the incarceration system. We're getting, you know, low wage jobs that don't include health insurance. And so what I experienced when I was living in New York in the summer of 2018, I didn't have health insurance. I had to use OpenPath, which is a great directory of low cost therapists. And so, but some of those therapists sometimes aren't necessarily offer the treatment modalities that we need. Some folks, Black folks, are dealing with what I have, which is borderline personality disorder, which requires a particular type of treatment modality, which is dialectical behavioral therapy. And so the challenge also is not having health insurance and not being able to afford some of the therapists that can offer some of the really in-depth treatment modalities that are needed.
You mentioned the modalities, the different type of treatment options, and you're very knowledgeable about what issues you're dealing with specifically and then what treatment you need for that. Where, Imadi, does race play into this? Is it important for you to make sure that your therapist is also Black?
Yeah, race plays a huge role because sometimes our symptoms are not considered symptoms. They're considered something that maybe we're making it up in our head. You know, maybe when that coworker said an insensitive comment to us, sometimes what I heard in the past when I had a non-Black therapist is that that therapist kind of turned into some into like almost like an investigative or a defense attorney. And so they're grilling me on like, are you sure this happened? Are you sure they said that? Are you sure you're having, maybe you're having a bad day? It was almost like I was made to prove that racism exists, that I was dealing with this racial incident at work. And so it was so hard for me to say, hey, like, I want this therapy to be a safe space where my experiences as a Black woman are not questioned as if it doesn't exist. And that was a huge challenge for me dealing with a non-Black therapist.
Dr. Joy, we know that healthcare disparities exist, particularly among racial lines. What is it, in your view, that makes it so important for Black people to have access to Black therapists in particular?
Well, I think just as Imadi has mentioned, just the idea that therapy should be one of the few safe spaces that you may have in your life. And so, you know, for people across the board really have difficulty making that first call to talk with a therapist. And so when you finally work up the courage and the nerve to make that call, and then you go to an experience that's invalidating, it makes it much more likely that people are not going to try therapy again. And so it's important for people to have experiences and spaces where their authenticity and their experiences are not questioned. And I think that is why so many Black people are looking for therapists who are also Black.
I mean, should someone stop looking if they can't find therapists of color? What do they do if they're not coming up with that? Is any therapy better than the best therapy that you think you might need?
I tend to think so, yes, because I don't think, you know, of course, there are definitely non-Black therapists who do create invalidating experiences. That definitely happens. But then there are some great therapists who are not Black. And so I think it is important, you know, if ideally you would love to work with another Black therapist, but your search is difficult and you're just not able to get that for whatever reason, I do think it is important to explore other opportunities, namely looking for someone who has the expertise in the area that you're struggling with, and to be very open with that person and talking about issues around race and culture. You know, some therapists are perfectly willing and, you know, excited about having that kind of conversation and want to do what they can to make sure that you do have a good experience with therapy. So I think if you can't find what you're looking for in terms of race and culture, then it's important to find someone who has the expertise and then share any concerns you have about microaggressions with that therapist.
Imadi, in your experience, I mean, are you noticing people in your own peer group either talking about wanting to access therapy more, talking about mental health issues more? Because I feel like there has been a shift, particularly among younger generations of people and women of color in particular, who are talking about these issues. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, I think that there is a huge cultural shift that's happening. I feel like I'm a part of the first generation of Black people that are openly saying they're going to therapy. I mean, definitely Black folks have been going to therapy for a long time, but I have not witnessed us actually communicating, you know, loudly that we're doing it in such an affirming way. And I think definitely Dr. Joy's is a huge part of that movement. I mean, Therapy for Black Girls, the directory, it's a huge game changer. Before, you know, the most that I can do to try to find a Black therapist is to go to Psychology Today. You know, you select African-American amongst the choices. But, you know, there was also a lot of white therapists in that list. So, you know, there really wasn't dedicated spaces where Black people can find therapists the way that we do now. And I think it's amazing. Even my mom, I mean, she has complete turnaround. She went from, you know, not thinking I need therapy to helping me pay for therapy. So it's a huge cultural shift that is happening as we are like loudly saying, you know, that Black people are worthy of mental health care.
Dr. Joy, any closing thoughts on that, in particular what white therapists could do better if they're treating patients of color, particularly Black patients?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's really important for white therapists to be able to name any concerns that might be existing in the space. So I know a lot of times people want to say like, oh, I'm not going to bring it up unless the client brings it up. But I think when the therapist actually brings it up, it makes it so that that issue is talkable, so to speak. So if I go to you and you say like, hey, I know that culturally we're different and I just want to let you know that it's okay to talk about any things. I'm human. I may make mistakes. Please let me know if there's something that I do that feels insensitive, and to really allow space for that conversation, I think is really important. You don't have to wait until the client brings up something to make sure that that issue is okay to be discussed in your space.
Dr. Joy Harden Bradford is a licensed psychologist and host of the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. And Amadi Bora is a writer and mental health advocate and the creator of Depressed While Black. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keep them squatters moving. Black people on this planet are supposed to be squatters forever.
Homeless mothers who were evicted after squatting in a vacant house in Oakland, California, may have reached an agreement that will allow them to move back in. The group Moms for Housing has drawn attention to California's broader housing crisis. And in this case, the real estate investment company that owns the house has agreed to sell. Molly Solomon from member station KQED explains what this will mean.
Outside Oakland City Hall, housing activists celebrated what they consider a victory. Dominique Walker of Moms for Housing calls the sale of the house to a community land trust a big win.
We're just happy. We're ready to buy Mom's house, and we're ready to continue this movement.
Under the agreement, real estate company Wedgwood Inc. would sell the West Oakland home to the Oakland Community Land Trust. Steve King is executive director of the trust. He says his group plans to fix up the home and sell it back to the moms. That way, King says, the house will remain permanently affordable.
So anytime the moms may want to sell, the house would be available to another low-income family, that it's permanently under community control and affordable.
The parties haven't agreed on a price, but Wedgwood said in a statement that it would not ask for more than the three-bedroom, one-bath home's appraised value. The company declined an interview request. But according to real estate site Zillow, the home's estimated value is just over $630,000. The company bought it earlier this year for $500,000 at a foreclosure auction. Oakland's mayor and California's governor helped negotiate the deal, which includes this provision. Wedgwood will also give the land trust the opportunity to purchase all its Oakland properties before putting them on the open market. The real estate company had initially refused to negotiate with the land trust, but now maintains it was always open to working out a deal, as long as the Moms for Housing left the house first. Following a court order, sheriff's deputies carried out a pre-dawn eviction raid last week and arrested two of the moms. Dominique Walker and Moms for Housing vowed to continue pressing elected officials on affordable housing and keeping companies like Wedgwood accountable.
We will not stop organizing and fighting until all unhoused folks who want shelter have shelter.
Their fight includes pushing California Governor Gavin Newsom to pursue state legislation that would ensure housing as a human right. For NPR News, I'm Molly Solomon in Oakland.
Very last thing, I saw where Odell Beckham tapped a cop on the butt after the national championship game. And the cop tried to charge him with sexual assault. And I said, wow. You know, it was like a tap on the butt, like you see football players do, and it was a male cop. But sexual assault.
An arrest warrant has been issued by the New Orleans, I guess, police department for Odell Beckham Jr., after a football player, of course, here, who was also an alum of the LSU Tigers, who just won a national championship game. So let's have the setup here. Odell Beckham Jr., who is an NFL player now, very outspoken, fiery wide receiver that people love and hate at the same time, showed up in the locker room after his College won the national championship game to celebrate with them. Apparently, a Superdome security officer was sifting through the crowd and was making sure that players and maybe other personnel in the locker room weren't doing things that they weren't supposed to do, like smoking cigars, maybe weed, maybe drinking. I'm not sure what he was looking for, but let's watch the video of what Odell Beckham Jr. did behind the security guard. We'll see it real fast. He's wearing the white shirt.
Hey, man, D. Lou finna go to jail, y'all. Hey. Hey. Hey, what about the big ugly?
No! Hey, man. Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Lord.
Missed it. In case you missed it, he was standing there. He hit him on his butt. Cop turned around fast. Oh, I'm sorry. He wasn't necessarily a cop. Again, it was a Superdome security officer who was checking for I'm not sure what. And then it kind of went from there. And we can continue to see as it happened. So, again, the officer's looking for something on number 68, who was a college player. Something around him. And there's the slap heard around the world.
Simple battery is what they want to charge him with. You got the simple part, right? What the hell? The idea, I guess, is that the players might be under the age of 21. Mm-hmm. So, or they're in a building and shouldn't be smoking cigars. They just won the national championship. The society in which they live celebrates these things with like champagne covering everybody. Beer commercials are filmed. Everyone, like, they put a beer in everyone's hand.
Yeah.
Now, let these guys who have managed to not only win the national championship, but also to have a full schedule of classes.
Yeah.
At the very least, the bare minimum. But in many cases, like, I remember in college, like, I could barely get through my class load. I can't imagine. I mean, you're an athlete. I can't imagine having both of those things to balance. Let them have a sparkling, like, hard cider without sifting through all their crap.
Well, again, and then they said they were warning them not to be lighting up cigars anymore in the locker room, which I'm not sure when it was happening before. I also wonder if they were sifting through the loser team's locker room, seeing if they had anything. Because, I mean, maybe some guys are depressed and upset after the game and like, man, I'm going to smoke. Who knows? But then, it's the degree to which they're coming after and trying to search through people's things when they just won, let them live for a second. If the Saints are just won a playoff game, which they did in a couple weeks ago, and they're in that same locker room celebrating, are they going through these adult grown men, professional millionaire athletes' lockers? I don't think they are.
These are, they're adults unless they're 17.
True, yeah,
they're
exactly,
of age.
Right? Yeah.
But it's so in your face. Like, these players just gave everyone in America an escape from the stupidity of, like, crappy law enforcement actions. Mm-hmm. Everybody was just watching football. And then the minute they get, also, they're not getting paid. So they have Let them celebrate. They have this guy coming and lifting up their Gatorade bottle to see if there's anything in it.
Yeah. Is there supposed to be a cigar in the Gatorade bottle? He's looking for more than cigars.
Yeah, and then Odell Beckham Jr. has had enough. And he slaps him on the butt. And then he starts dancing like it's a good time.
He's definitely drunk. He's been in the league long enough to probably be like, what is going on? Like, what are they doing here? You know what? I'm a millionaire athlete. I'm going to go ahead and test my luck. So apparently, they also attempted to charge him also with a misdemeanor sexual battery, they mentioned. But the judge declined that part. You know what happened here, I think?
Yeah.
Speculation here.
What is it?
But our angry officer here who was sifting through everyone's things, he went back to the headquarters. His fellow officers were giving him trouble for it. They're like, Odell got you. Oh, you chump. Oh, you sucker. Oh, did it hurt? Did you like it? Like, they gave him all kinds of hell for it. And he probably was like, man, F this. We're going to go get him. He's tired of getting clowned on. The sensitive folks, especially when it comes to, like, you know, people of any kind of authority, they'd be like, I can't believe he did that to me. I'm going to get him. I'm going to show him because that video is going to circulate and people are going to talk trash about me.
He's a security officer. It seems like there is,
everyone is, he's a security officer, he's not a police officer. I was expecting like that thing where if you so much as touch a police officer, they're gonna open fire on you. But this guy isn't. Yeah, he
must not have had a gun because he's
butthurt, for a lack of a better term. And then
he definitely wound up.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't light, but like, come on. It's so weird to take all this stuff. The other thing that Odell Beckham Jr. was doing was giving out money to the players.
That's awesome.
And so now I just read that they're starting to review the process by which celebrities and specifically famous alumni are granted field access in those certain situations. Uh-huh. But like, he was just giving money to these kids.
If he gives out money, you know what they're gonna be like? An illegal,
trying to make this
an illegal payment to a college player.
I know, that stuff's so stupid.
It's gonna happen. They're gonna be like, how much did you get from Odell Beckham that night? $100?
That's what they're looking into. It's like, I just won this whole school. It maybe $1 billion. You know, we just solidified Orgeron's position here as a force to be reckoned with, a national championship winner. He is shifting the balance of the SEC, whatever. Yeah. I don't know what they're West. And for years to come. And he just won the national championship. He did so much for that university. He did so, I mean, and these, and there's a different, just let them have.
I hope Orgeron speaks up for his players for what they went through.
You know, first ladies usually have a cause. And you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt. And we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Sound stories, sound voices. I'm Kim Malcolm. A Seattle police officer has been fired for making derogatory and politically charged posts on Instagram. KUOW's Amy Radel is here to tell us more. Amy, hi.
Hi there.
So the officer in question has not yet been named, but what do we know about what he allegedly posted on Instagram?
He made two posts that have been under investigation. They both contained more profanity than we're going to mention here. But essentially, one was a picture of a package bomb that said, "I don't condone package bombs," but then appeared to endorse violence against Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And the second post was a photo of the officer himself giving the middle finger and ranting against those who support illegal immigrants. An anonymous acquaintance who saw these posts and was concerned filed a complaint with Seattle's Office of Police Accountability.
And even though these posts were made on the officer's personal social media account, they violated the Seattle Police Department's policy.
Yeah, they determined that they did. The department's social media policy says officers shouldn't post things, even on personal accounts, that hurt SPD's ability to serve the public. The OPA in its report said it's not a policy violation for police officers to have views that are at odds with those of the community they serve. But they found that the tenor and the vitriol in this officer's comments raised the question of whether he could provide services to undocumented people as a police officer. Investigators did not find that this officer has engaged in biased policing, but they did find that both posts were unprofessional and they did harm the department's ability to serve the public. And after this investigation, that's when he was terminated by Chief Carmen Best.
And Amy, he identified himself online as a police officer, yes?
There were definitely indications. He had the word officer in his username on Instagram, and that immigration post that we talked about had hashtags with the words police, cops, and Blue Lives Matter. So he definitely gave hints that he was in law enforcement as he's saying these things about immigrants.
So what did this officer have to say about these allegations?
SPD has not released his name, but in the report, he was interviewed by investigators and he admitted to writing these posts. He said he didn't think that they showed bias because he said he was criticizing illegal immigration as a practice and not undocumented individuals specifically. But he did recognize that these posts were unprofessional and they did hurt SPD's ability to serve the public. And he said in hindsight, he would not have written them.
Amy, what else do we need to know about this story?
It might jog some memories about another big flare-up around a Seattle police officer who used social media in 2015, right when they unveiled this policy. Her name was Officer Cynthia Whitlatch. She was separately found to have engaged in misconduct and biased policing when she wrongfully arrested an African-American man who was using a golf club as a cane. And right around that same time, someone filed a complaint about her social media posts. This was right in the wake of the Ferguson protests. And she accused African Americans of racism that she said exceeds white racism. Officer Whitlatch was also fired. She appealed her termination, and eventually the city settled with her, and she got $100,000 in back pay. And of course, this latest firing could be appealed and later get modified as well.
So what's the bigger picture here? The department is still under federal oversight.
That's right. They're trying to get out from federal oversight after a multi-year reform process. The federal judge says there's been major progress in a lot of different areas, but he has flagged SPD's discipline system, these appeals and reversals, as a concern, specifically these types of misconduct findings. So we're heading into new negotiations for the next police guild contract, so we can expect that disciplinary process to be an important point of discussion there. This officer hasn't filed an appeal yet. We don't know if he will, but we will be watching for those next steps.
KUOW's Amy Radel telling us about the Seattle police officer who was fired for making inflammatory and derogatory posts on Instagram. Amy, thank you.
You're welcome.
Velvet Africa, free. Move member Velvet Africa, held in prison since the confrontation of August 8, 1978. Has walked out of a Pennsylvania prison after 42 years. Delbert, in his 69th year of life, came out to meet other members of the MOVE organization, Ramona, Pam, Janet, Janine, Mo, Mary, Carlos, and Consuela, Africa, who greeted him with a hearty chant of Long Live John Africa, and a MOVE salute. Del was in a good mood and high spirits, cracking jokes and eating sandwiches. August 8, 1978 was a date of infamy, for it marked an attack on the MOVE house in West Philadelphia's Powelton Village, where hundreds of cops shot thousands of shots into the structure where men, women, and children were huddled in the basement. Gunfire was followed by water cannons, where MOVE people had to fight to stay alive from being drowned. When Delbert exited the house, he was beaten by several cops, rifle-butted, stomped, and kicked viciously. When several of these cops were charged with assaulting Dell, they had nothing to worry about. Thanks to Judge Stanley Kubaki, ignoring videotapes, he acquitted the cops, citing, among other things, Delbert's muscles as justification for the beating. Ironically, one of those cops charged might have been luckier if he were sent to prison. For several weeks after the trial, he was shot and paralyzed by his wife, who also happened to be a cop. Delbert Africa, MOVE member, walks free after 42 years in the joint. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 25, 2020. So I have been told. I will pause immediately. I know I have done a lot of boasting about the best plantation in the Western Hemisphere,
Seattle, Washington, I have done a lot of bragging over the years. Been here the entire time that we have done the Cal's broadcast. I do not call it a city. That is deliberate. It has been deliberate for years. I say, best plantation. Don't you think for a second that I have got up here, Mount Rainier, all the yoga, yummy food, Pike Place Market, rubbing elbows with Russell Wilson, or I guess that's a metaphor. Being in close proximity, Marshawn Lynch, having Skittles, all of that. Don't you think for a second I have forgotten we are still in the system of white supremacy racism. I make sure to point out examples of that all the time. The enforcement officer who was not named in that segment here in Seattle, white man, doesn't get identified, making threats, really terroristic threats, against the sitting president, terroristic threats against the presidential candidate in 2016 and 2008. And they don't even identify him. And it's, wow, he didn't say something racist. It's, he said things that were inflammatory. We didn't check his record for racist white supremacist conduct. We checked his record for bias. I don't even know what all that would entail. Are we going to see if he called someone a coon during the arrest? Did he call them a nigger? I don't know. Can't even get a name, though. They give that one. Got to get protection. Anonymity. I assume this is not a minor. I don't think they let 14-year-old white girls or boys become enforcement officials. So I will assume that this is someone who is over the age of 18. Why would we be protecting their anonymity? System of white supremacy. Speaking of yoga, I did slip that in. The Cow's Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat, Toronto. The dates, May 21 through May 24. The 21st is a Thursday. The 24th is a Sunday. Toronto, Ontario, Canada. We will be doing yoga every day. Plant-based meals for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We'll have counter-racist workshops, food workshops on how to prepare some of the wonderful plant-based yumminess that Chef Nadira will be coming to Toronto to prepare our meals. She's done all the cuisine at our two retreats thus far, Virginia and Florida. Looking forward to having her with us in Toronto. Toronto is a great city to visit. If you've not been, I think you will have a grand time. We'll be there in late spring, so hopefully we'll begin to get a taste of the summer weather. But looking forward to hanging out. All of the information is on my blog. It should be listed, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Very first post that you'll see has all of the details. The price for the retreat is $660 US. That includes lodging, all the meals, yoga. You just have to get yourself to Toronto. Deposit of $400 is due on February 29th. The remaining $260 due May 1st. 50% discount for children ages 10 to 14. Again, all of this information is on the blog. You can drop an email if you have questions that are not answered on the blog post. If you need additional information, untiljustice@gmail.com. Just drop me a line and we'll try to clear up any confusion. I did have one person write in and they said they're excited about the retreat, looking forward to participating. I think they said they had a friend who went to one of the previous retreats, and the friend highly encouraged her to come visit with us. She said, I'm all excited to go, but I don't know about this plant-based meals for 3-4 days. And in fact, I don't know that I trust you to keep me nourished and well-fed, so I'm getting permission now to smuggle in a hamburger, chicken sandwich, maybe a few potato chips. I thought, two retreats in,
we had enough folks who, you know, experienced the food, that we wouldn't have that those types of queries anymore, because we certainly did have people saying that the first time around in Virginia. I promise, if you are not a vegetarian, you're not a vegan, you know, you right there, the first clip that we had, McDonald's, get your Big Mac, your chicken nuggets, French fries. That's, you know, a regular part of your weekly diet. Not a problem. Most of the people that have come to the retreat thus far, unless I'm super confused or a lot of folks lied, most of them were not vegans when they got there. I don't think anybody in Virginia or Florida, I don't think we had one person who was giving me a slant eye, looking at Nadira crazy, looking to make an excuse to get out and see if they could find a Subway, a Wendy's, a can of dog food, anything. I don't think that was the case. I think everybody unanimously, I think in both states, unanimously applauded and cheered the food. I don't recall anyone saying that they were starving, that they had really small portions, or that Gusty, you know, tricked us all the way out here and is thinking that we're just going to subsist off of cauliflower and kale and carrots and then brag about it. You know, he is a freaking loon, and I will never do this again. That was not the case at all. We have an abundance of photographs from Florida. You can see what we ate. We had veggie pizza, we had veggie lasagna, we had sweet potato pie, we had apple pie, we had peanut butter cookies, we had kale salad, we had vegan macaroni and cheese. I mean, it was a pretty endless, delicious, endless parade of deliciousness in both Virginia and Florida. The carrot hot dogs that everyone raved about two different times. The vegan potato salad, we had that in Virginia. I mean, we just had so much deliciousness. The cauliflower fried chicken. Photos of all of this. So I promise it might be different. It might be different food than what you're accustomed to, which is great. But if you give it a try, I don't think you'll starve. And I think you, in fact, might enjoy some of the victuals. So don't be discouraged. Don't be dismayed. Hopefully, if we have any folks who participated in the retreat, if you can speak to, stand as a witness to the food, that would be grand, just to make sure that folks know they are not going to starve. Even though I did on my yoga have been vegan for over 2 years now, I still weigh over 200 pounds. So Gus T is not trying to starve or be famished for 4 days either. I intend to eat everybody else to eat as much as they need to be fully satisfied and, you know, ready to go out and have a good time. I've been saying north of the border, but one of us will not be traveling north to get to Toronto. Learn a little bit about everything. Polish your geography. Seattle is so far away from everything, and particularly so far north. Gus T will actually be traveling south to get to Toronto. That notwithstanding, the rest of you all that are traveling north, May 21 to May 24, drop an email if you need any additional information. Folks in the northwest area, New York, Pennsylvania, New England, should take advantage of us being so close right there. Get your passport, May 21 through May 24, going to Canada. Let's see, other details to get for the broadcast. Oh, speaking of yoga, if there are people in the Seattle area, if you are interested in practicing tomorrow afternoon, that would be Sunday, the 26th, let me know. You can come practice. I am teaching the class tomorrow evening, so we can do a little yoga, nothing too strenuous, not heated. You don't have to be an expert, not doing any inversions or headstands or anything like that. Just do a little movement, burn a few calories, get some stretching in, hopefully feel good for your Sunday afternoon. Let me know. Class is at 4 p.m. I can get you all of the details if you would like to come out and practice on a Sunday afternoon. With that, a few things to touch on before we move forward. The segment on McDonald's at the very beginning I thought was fascinating. We've talked about different ways that black people get inundated with terrible food options, where it's not Whole Foods that's doing all of that. I found so many aspects of that compelling, not just there's a black business component, some of the black people that own these franchises. And then she talked about the overdependence, that McDonald's might be the only site in the area where you have Wi-Fi access. The only site where you can go to get, you know, coffee in the morning, get out of rain as you're waiting to transition to work or to school, that sort of thing. Again, contrasting that with Seattle, with, you know, 25 libraries and a Starbucks on every corner and all the rest of it, and Whole Foods on every other corner, and literally a farmer's market on every other block that you could conveniently walk to, and many of them are year-round, so you would have year-round access to extremely fresh, high-quality organic produce. Just the contrast is extraordinary. And just that alone, where even if you are trying to eat healthy, we don't have Wi-Fi, this is the only Wi-Fi spot, that has an impact, just having you in proximity with that nonsense food and everything that's associated with that, where you'll be more like, well, maybe today I'll get a shake. Well, maybe today I'll get an apple pie. Sometimes they give it away just because you're there using the Wi-Fi. Like, here's a Big Mac on us. They'll, like, give it to you. Just, get that. Got to get a little grease in you. Got a little cholesterol in you. Yeah, might even be an Impossible Burger because they got that now. Here, get some fries with that, too. But I did think that segment was important. I do want to try to get that book. What You Eat is massively important. Vitality towards replacing white supremacy with justice. We talked about the Odell Beckham Jr. segment from last week. I think Thomas in New York mentioned that. They brought that up. Let's see. The segment about the guns down in Virginia. I actually saw a number of reports where white people were asserting that the coon man was doing all of this deliberately to detract from his racist conduct. Now, some of the white people, I think, had an agenda of saying, wait a minute now, he looks like he's trying to make some changes to gun laws that I don't support. And so that was their means of attacking him and saying that this fella is a racist, coon man, and that he's doing, because he declared a state of emergency in Virginia, and that he's doing all of this. So it'll be a nice big dramatic charade, take everybody's attention off of, hey, aren't we supposed to be getting rid of this guy? I don't think that's the case. I think if they were going to do that, they would have done that last year. I just think it's important. He should be remembered. And just for a moment, this is the type of illustration when they rekindled the memory of Heather Hare, the white woman who died in Charlottesville, where I said consistently her memory will be used. This will be John Brown 21st century, where we can cite a white woman, no less, who gave the ultimate sacrifice down in the Commonwealth of Virginia, fighting the good fight against racism and no goodniks like the folks they arrested this week, and why we've got to have a state of emergency. We're not going to have a repeat of that. The value of white life, white female life on display. Heather Hare. Let's see. The Delbert Africa segment. Man, I'm so, well, I don't know a better word. I was going to say sad. That might not be the best word. In fact, I do not think that is the most accurate term to describe my thoughts, feelings around it. But every single time, it's almost every time I hear Mumia Abu-Jamal, Sue Africa. In the archives, would have been better if we had never interviewed her, because that will permanently adjust how I think about everybody associated with the MOVE organization. But I was waiting when they did the roll call of all the people who were present to welcome Delbert Africa out of greater confinement, 42 years. I didn't hear Sue Africa. Maybe I missed it. I'm a victim of racism. Maybe my hearing is bad. If you all heard Sue Africa's name mentioned in the roll call, please let me know. I'll go back and listen to the audio segment again. But I didn't hear her name. Not that it would have made me feel better if she had been present. I think we had talked about before when we read Mumia's book. I'm not sure if she was affiliated with the organization in 1978 when this original incident happened. I'm not sure if she came aboard until later on, closer to 1985, when they had the actual bombing at Osage Avenue and burned down the 60 houses, black-owned houses, and what have you. But neither here nor there. Did not hear from Sue Africa today, thankfully. I'm glad Delbert Africa released. Hope everybody will be released who has been in greater confinement for 42 years. And I'm reminded Mumia Abu-Jamal asked a really important question around that because he was a journalist. This happened before he was incarcerated. Do you know who fired the shot that killed the officer? The reason Delbert Africa has been in greater confinement for 42 years. And the powerful white people in Philadelphia conceded. No, we don't know who fired the shot. How is anybody in jail if you don't know who fired the shot? System of racism, white supremacy, because we said so. Let's see. The last thing I'll get in, the situation in Oakland, the housing situation where they said, I mean, it sounded like they were saying that this was a win and they're going to allow these black moms to purchase the housing. I generally feel like white people in a system of white supremacy, I mean, that's all close to Silicon Valley and whites who have lots and lots of resources. If I heard correctly, they said that house was something, some piddling figure like $600,000. Not that, you know, that's chump change for me. Just saying in a system of racism, white supremacy, and particularly for Bay Area real estate, that is, you know, nothing. That's the type of thing when I mean that white people could solve this problem today. There's no reason in 2020 black mothers, really anybody, but black mothers should be squatting in a house in the Bay Area, in a vacant house, no less, should be squatting and then evicted and got to go through all this. And I mean, really? In 2020, that's the best we can do. That's the best that we can do to correct the housing situation. Not at all. Those type of reminders, I think, are important. This is not a problem that should take 50,000 years, and people come up with those insane figures that this problem will take 50,000 years to solve. This problem will take 1 million years to solve. It won't be in, you know, my great, 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 great grandchildren's lifetime. That is all nonsense. This problem could be solved in the next hour. All right, we're going to get these coons a place to stay. Where's the deed? Sign it up. Boom. They could knock that out today. Like, what are you talking about? They waste money on nonsense that's more than $600,000. We'll waste that much money to go blow somebody up and then say it's an accident. That right there, system of white supremacy, super said. It took me a while to grasp that, to accept that that is true. This problem could be solved right now. That is a false statement and probably a lie. Anytime that someone says that, especially if they're white, that this problem is going to take decades and thousands of years to solve, hundreds of years. This problem could be solved before we get to the beginning of the new week. That's not what white people want to do. They like what they have. With that, number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Give it our weekly reminder, request, really. This is the only broadcast that I make this request. If we could not use metaphors, that would be appreciated. My conclusion, race soldiers regularly will invoke analogies, metaphors, similes, various comparisons. This is a huge component of how they practice deception, white supremacy. They'll also take two separate entities and insist that they are identical, exactly the same. Frequently, that is not the case at all. Victims of white supremacy, myself included, we've been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. And many of us, we are still learning. As such, we don't always have logic to articulate our views, which is fine. But the problem happens that sometimes we substitute an analogy, metaphor of some sort, in place of logic. Frequently, that just generates a lot more confusion. If we could be direct, specific with what it is we are trying to say, Much appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors, words, language. Very important. If we could take about 5 minutes to share thoughts, comments, questions, suggestions, whatever it is you want to share with us, and then mute your line. If you know you are in a noisy environment, television is on, people are partying, raucous Saturday evening, get to a quiet spot, quiet as possible, share your thoughts, and then mute your line. Again, 5 minutes for your comments. And then once everybody's had at least one opportunity to speak, then if you have additional questions, comments that you want to share with us, feel free. I think the archive for the broadcast last week might not be uploaded yet. I'm still a little congested and have not been feeling very well, although I'm much better than where I was last week. But that is what caused the delay, Gus having a slight lapse in health. But as I'm feeling better, I started getting things back up and uploaded and all that. So the compensatory call-in, I think, should be uploaded by the time we conclude today's broadcast. I think most of the other content slowly started getting uploaded. All of the book club sessions with a Terrible Thing to Waste. They should all be uploaded. Wow, what a read. If you have not picked through the archives or done any reading, tuned into the live segments, Harriet A. Washington, spectacular again. And this is a very recent book. This book just came out a few months ago, 2019. So A Terrible Thing to Waste, Harriet A. Washington, brilliant as usual. With that, first few folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Ohio.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. Definitely appreciated the segment. I think it was titled Depressed While Black. I thought it had some really good information and actually made me think about the story that I have had, and where just thinking about seeking counseling and at first having trouble finding Black therapists. But one thing that I noticed in Ohio, unlike in Nevada, is that just Googling, you know, Black whatever, if you want a Black therapist or dentist, doctor, whatever, there's typically some type of website that'll help direct you. And then also, if that's maybe not the case in an area where someone is, some insurance companies, they do have links to, like, the doctors that include pictures, or you can even cross-reference, like, a doctor with the office that they're at, and then also Google their name, and you might even be able to find, like, a picture of them, which is something I've done before when I was in Nevada. And when the Black female, when she had brought up the story about telling her mother that she wanted to go to therapy, and how her mother said, well, did you pray about it? And that's exactly the same response that I had gotten before. So I just thought that that was interesting. The other thing, which I thought, I guess kind of ties into the segments about depression and everything. I was actually watching the news and, reading the paper, and in Columbus, there was this, weatherman. He was a weatherman on, I think it was 10 TV for 30 years. And recently he had been arrested for having possessed over 15,000 images of child pornography. And they said that he, a white man, he said that he was gathering all these images because he suffered from depression, anxiety, and compulsive hoarding. And that was how he was self-medicating. And I thought that that was interesting, just like with these other segments where either they won't tell you, you know, they won't release the white man's name, like with the police officer in Seattle, or like with this white man, it just recently came out that that's going to actually be a part of his defense about him being so depressed and him not really knowing how to deal with his depression or anxiety. That's the reason why he had to collect all these different images of young girls. So that it just, you know, that helps me to better understand just their white people's legal system and how they use discretion. And also on one of the news segments that they were talking about him, they had said that they didn't want to overcharge him since he was in the public eye. And they also didn't want to undercharge him as far as his crime. But they brought up a statistic saying that 83% of people who had some type of child pornography, they actually don't serve jail time at all. And they made it really, and on the news segment, it was portrayed like pedophiles, they should have sympathy because they can't really get the help that they need, get the mental health services that they need without having some type of punitive response to it. And I think that that is, you know, that's correct. Not like the black female in that segment where she was just depressed and it was going, and she would have some type of punitive effort or, you know, response to her depression without having any, at least from what she said, any type of like, you know, criminal linking to her depression. But that's all I'll share for now. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, Red in Ohio. I thought that was an important segment as well. The medical apartheid, Harriet A. Washington. I am a little bit resentful. Sorry, had to clear my throat. I am a little bit resentful when they say black people have some sort of, what is it, cultural hang-ups about seeking therapy, counseling. In a system of white supremacy, when you have books like Protest Psychosis, where it's been an act of institutional white supremacy, where in mass they'll say, oh, these niggers are trying to get away from the plantation. That's draftomania. Oh, these niggers are upset about us killing them. That's schizophrenia. Or they'll just come out with, you know, any other ailment, mental disorder. And, oh, yeah, that's what the nigger has. Yes, we'll lock him up and lock her up, give him some drugs, and, you know, that'll be that. Much less, you don't have any black therapist, much less Dr. Frances Cress Welsing and her experience as a third-generation physician, general and child psychiatrist. It's not like she was embraced. Yes, tell us about your theories to help explain the coon. That's not what her experience was. Fired from Howard University, HBCU. Much less than the black people that we've had come on this very program and say, man, I went to a therapist. I wanted counseling. I didn't have any cultural hangups. I wasn't like the rest of these colored folks. I went to get help. And I went and I wanted to talk about racism and they told me to hush. We've had a number of folks, males and females, who've come on and said, yep, that was my experience. I tried to go and talk about racism. They told me to hush up. In fact, some folks said that they got punitive. There's that word again. If you think that I'm going to enable and allow you to just come in here every other week for a session and blame white people for your problems, you've got another thing going. They got a thing called personal responsibility. That's what I've heard repeatedly, going to get a white counselor. And even sometimes if it's a black counselor who does not embrace, talk about white supremacy, racism, all of that. And then it turns around and consistently it'll just be, oh yeah, niggas got hangups about, you know, counseling. Yeah. The colored folk. You can't get over their superstitions. The colored folks. All of that said, I do appreciate Red confirming that happened to her as well about going to pray to it. White, and even that system of racism, white supremacy. Who is to blame for that? Maybe I'm exaggerating. Other folks who dialed in, hand up if you have comments, questions, suggestions to share. Line should be open. *61. Folks are spectating. I do see other hands up. I don't know if they're waiting to get to a spot where they can speak. The other folks that are hanging out, let us know if you had suggestions, thoughts, observations from the past seven.
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Josh. Good evening to all the callers, Red, in Ohio, and everyone else that will call in. I wonder how much of the emphasis on mental health in the black community or black amongst black people has increased since Kanye West has brought attention to it. And also Charlamagne wrote a book where he was talking about dealing with mental health. They kind of made it mainstream, and people were talking about it more. However, I am quite reluctant to go to a white psychologist or a psychiatrist. I have gone to speak to someone in the past when I was younger, and it was a white person, and I don't remember the experience being pleasant, but I don't remember the experience that well. To emphasize what you were talking about, Gus, that we can, this is a problem that can be fixed pretty quickly. I've been doing some YouTubing, and it's a bunch of videos on some of the marvelous things that the Chinese have built in a relatively small amount of time, and just to look at what they've been able to do. It's not like it can't be duplicated. In particular, unfortunately, they're dealing with this coronavirus, and I actually have the patent number for it. I have to read it later. But you're definitely man-made, made in a laboratory in Britain, and patented here in the United States in 2018. The ink didn't even dry on a trade deal, and all of a sudden they get hit with this Wuhan disease. And I call it Wu-Tang disease because the Wu-Tang, in one of their songs, mentioned this disease. But either way, they're building a hospital, I guess, in 5 days now. Yesterday it was 6 days. And the Chinese are trying to build a whole hospital, electricity, plumbing, 1,000 rooms, excuse me, in 5 days now. And, in their country, if you don't do it, things happen. So I expect them to have it done. Anything can be done in this system, if you put your mind to it and people are dedicated and working in accordance like they are to get things to happen. But either way, I just want people to be very cautious of this coronavirus because we don't know what the effects is going to have on us once it gets here. The last thing I wanted to say this week, Gus, and report came out saying by the year 2021, it gave each state how many of the jobs will become automated by that year, meaning that a computer or robot will do the job instead of a person. And with no surprise, the number one state was Alabama. And Florida wasn't too far behind. So when you look at the South, they're in the – and when I say number one state, Alabama, actually Florida's number one. 31.5% of the jobs they have right now being done by people are slated to be done by automated devices by 2021. That's just next year. Alabama is 31.4%. And when you look at this map, every state is bad, but the states with the most black people have the highest percentage. I don't think that's by accident. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, guys.
Not by accident at all. Matter of fact, you can look. They have a registry of racist slurs. They'll have Coon and all the rest of them on there, but it's thousands of them. You wouldn't believe how much time and energy white people devote to this. Racists. But one of them, for black people, it's antiquated farm equipment. That's one of the little acronyms that they have for black people. Antiquated farm equipment, AFE. That'll be what they call black people. That's what that segment made me think of. They'll be using that big time. We don't need the Negro for anything. So over on the side. Let's see. Other folks, number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Blue.
Greetings, guests, and to all of the callers. A few things. With Richmond, Virginia, I find it very interesting that people who classify themselves as white start to have specific designations of racism, white supremacy, from we're not white supremacists or extreme left or extreme right, when historically the Second Amendment, the creation of the NRA, along with simultaneously the creation of the Ku Klux Klan, all of this began to ensure that so-called African Americans or ex-African slaves would not have access to firearms. So ultimately, these are white racist attempts to keep their Second Amendment rights and to ensure that non-white people, primarily mostly non-white black people, do not have access to guns. No matter how much they talk about the diversity within the so-called gun culture, an example with like the Black Panthers, after they showed up at the Capitol, I believe it was in Oakland or Sacramento, either one, I forget, gun laws immediately changed. So it'd be interesting to see what would happen if several million so-called African Americans showed up to any type of Second Amendment rally, licensed carry gun permit holders would show up, and what would the result be? Secondly, for anyone that's out there that's listening that is thinking about coming to Toronto, I can make a testimony that all of the meals from breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you will be well fed, whether you come in as a specific meat eater, a person who is trying veganism or vegetarianism for the first time. Chef Indira, along with Gusty Renegade, were both superb in all of the recipes and all of the dishes, all of the snacks that they made. Everyone was quite filled and very satisfied with all of the meals, sometimes to the point where people even had to take momentary naps and rest. And the nighttime yoga was extraordinary for the fulfilling meals that we shared throughout the day. I was also thinking about the now with protesters, particularly non-white black protesters or just non-white protesters in general, social media and how that has been affecting how non-white protesters are being monitored throughout the nation, going to protest, where the protests are being held. It's very difficult to try and navigate not being seen and monitored, no matter how vigilant protesters are with, say, turning off their geolocation, being less specific on social media like Facebook or Twitter to talk about protests. So that is an issue that I'm sure will persist for quite some time, because the FBI, COINTELPRO, CIA, all types of different agencies have multiple ways of monitoring all of our location devices, which come in the form of cell phone. And that's all I have to say. I meet my line. Greetings and a good night to all of the callers. Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Much obliged, Mr. Blue, with us in Florida. Hope, folks, if you are thinking about coming to Toronto, I forgot to include, for all of the retreats thus far, Chef Nadira, she has prepared the menu in advance. So every time, folks have had an opportunity to see all of the meals. This is what we'll be eating for the time that we're there. You get an opportunity. Oh, man, that doesn't look too tasty. I don't know about that one. giving folks that opportunity. And I've asked, do folks have any preference, something that you like specifically, if it's things that you know you don't like or that sort of thing. Generally speaking, people have not been, you know, very finicky and saying, oh, I don't want to try that. I know I don't want that up front, or I don't like carrots. I'm not touching that. Like, as long as you can be open-minded, I think Chef Nadira will be able to take care of your palate for 4 days, 3 nights. In fact, more than take care of. You should be pretty darn satisfied with the victuals for 4 days, 3 nights in Toronto. Not sure if I'm going to do the sweet potato pie or not. As I said before, I like to be seasonal with the produce that is available, but blueberry cobbler. Springtime, blueberries should be fresh. Blueberry cobbler. May 21 through May 24. Counter Racist Yoga Retreat comes to Toronto. Drop an email if you need any information. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks have other questions, suggestions, comments, news items they would like to share, reflect, feel free. Lots of spectators for the evening. Hopefully, folks are in a spot where they can talk, where it doesn't have to be a lot of background noise and competition. I'm not sure if there are any cool parties or anything going on that I missed for the weekend, but hopefully they'll get it together. Not for spectating this broadcast. I said that for the one yesterday as well. Workplace racism, the compensatory call-in. This is not the come-in. We're just going to sit and hang out and lollygag and listen to whatever the Negroes have to say. You have things to share, comments, suggestions, observations, feel free. 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Boop. Other folks who dialed in that we missed totally.
Hello, can I be heard? Oh, am I coming in clear?
Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't want to be a spectator, and thank you for letting me say something. I just wanted to speak on the surveillance, so... we know that black people have been surveillance since we were brought over here. But the surveillance with the technology now, I just don't think white people are serious about the missing persons epidemic that we have, or especially the missing children, because if they can surveil all those people for whatever reason they want to surveil them for, I'm pretty sure they can, it would be pretty easy to find people that are missing. So I just wanted to throw that out there, that I don't think that white people, be it law enforcement or even if it's higher up, FBI or CIA, I just don't think they're that serious about finding missing people, just speaking on the technology that they have access to now. It seemed like it would be a lot easier, but you still have the same amount, if not more, people missing in the United States and worldwide. And I was glad to hear about the mental health segment as well. I know I live in Iowa, and I just don't think that the therapists are serious about it. I don't think that the therapists are serious about it. I know that I tried to get some help, and I just didn't feel like they really took me serious. I felt like, just like what the speaker was saying, that They ask you a bunch of questions. If you bring up maybe something that has to do with race and you know it was something to do with race, they want to question you and, like, get to the bottom of why would you think that was about race. So I just don't think that they are serious about that stuff. And so thank you for letting me speak, and thank you.
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to ask really quick for your therapist. Were you able to see a white mental health professional or a black mental health professional?
Yeah, the part of Iowa that I live in, yeah, it was a white person. Yep. I looked for some black professional help people, but there were none in my area, so I did have to go to a white person.
Have heard that before. That's why I said, like, well, I think in my view, that would be a reason to have cultural hangups about going to a therapist. Now, if I'm going to have to go to a racist to talk about racism, I might be a little hesitant. You don't have any black therapists, I might be a little hesitant. Heard that from a lot of listeners where they, rightfully so, had some hesitancy about going to speak to a white person. Now, I will add, we did do multiple programs on depression. We had a black male participate, Blacker. You can go back in the archives. He went to a white healthcare professional. He said it was helpful. Not that he didn't think she was racist. Make sure I get that there. Not that he didn't conclude she's a racist. He did. But he said she was able to give strategies that he was able to implement on his own independently. So he could go talk to her. They met whatever it was. It might be weekly or every other week, whatever it is. And she would give him specific things that he could do. And then he could just do those when he wasn't with her. And he said that they were helpful, some of the exercises that she gave him. So I certainly understand that's not everyone's experience. We all have, you know, you're seeing a different person. We all have a different problem, that sort of thing. But I have heard from a number of folks frustrations about going to see white people. We also have a few folks who've said, you know, they have been helpful, even though you still got to have your guard up and do some counter-racism. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, suggestions. I guess if we have other folks who have some experience with getting counseling, that would be good to know. If you've had a non-white counselor, especially, because I do know some folks who, you know, waited out, sought out non-white counselors. In fact, I remember Chantel. She's called in a number of times over the years. She talked about her therapy. In fact, she found a black counselor who knew about Dr. Welsing. She thought that made her sessions extremely constructive, because then she got to talk about racism directly and how that impacted her experience. So, yeah, if we have any folks, if you have any history speaking with a therapist, white or non-white, if you would like to share, that would be good to know, especially if you found a black therapist. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we have missed you totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone on the line. DCS program, we met today. The featured part of today was the annual visit of a gorgeous black lady who clinicked financial literacy to the young fellows for about an hour and a half. And as usual, she did an excellent job into sharing her understandings and views on that subject. I had a talk with the young fellows. I first allowed them to pick the subject. I gave them Mr. Fuller's understandings of the nine areas of people activity. They picked entertainment. So with that, in my part of the discussion, I basically was stating the importance of no matter what part of entertainment that you would like to venture into, understand the business side of entertainment, whether it's in sports or some sort of other entertainment that people. And then I gave a even more broader understanding of entertainment, how some people consider entertainment as mistreating other people as a form of entertainment. You know, I've talked about that aspect of the word itself to broaden their understanding that they didn't look at entertainment in such ways also. I guess that's something that I feel I have to do when I'm in front of a lot of non-white people, no matter what their age is. Yes, on at the retreat, anyone who is attempting to make a visit, that's one thing that you definitely don't have to worry about. If the food aspect, you will get more than enough of very good food. With me, I got to the point where on some days I couldn't eat anymore because it was and it was still plenty left. The only thing is that Gus got to make more peanut butter cookies for me. I enjoyed the peanut butter cookies. Yes, and that's my weekly report. Thank you.
Much obliged. Those are so easy to make. Those are like 10 minutes. You can make those super. I mean, that's one of the easiest things that we made there. Peanut butter cookies, the vegan peanut butter cookies. I can get that. I got the recipe for the sweet potato pie is posted. I don't know if Mr. Blue was able to check it, but it is available. Even though the sweet potato pie that I made once I got back to Seattle, I think was a tad better. Woo. But the one that I made at the retreat, recipe is posted, and the cookies are even easier. That's, yeah, anybody, that's like 10 minutes. I think most of the time for that is get the oven to heat and super, super easy. Get good peanut butter, and those are easy to replicate. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, questions, suggestions, comments you would like to share, feel free. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Woo! Chef Nadir, man, did us right. Let's see. Folks are spectating. I will make sure I get in again. If we have folks who are spectating, if you have had any experience with a therapist, white or non-white, constructive or no, that would be good to hear. As I said, we have had some folks who said that they have had a constructive experience. It was helpful. They would recommend it for others. We had some other folks where it was not as helpful. And frustration in trying to find a non-white therapist or just an environment, yeah, a non-white therapist where you can bring up racism. I've heard that pretty consistently. Not being able to find someone where you can talk about how that is the problem. Dr. Wellesley used to say that we're not coming here and getting a whole lot of drugs and nonsense. We are going to talk honestly about the problem that is feeding into all these other problems in our existence. Very rare to get someone where you'll have that type of space where they'll have that sort of understanding. Other folks, let's see. *61 if you have comments, questions, suggestions to add. Let's see, while we're waiting for folks, if they're spectating, the other folks who are with us, if you have an additional comment you would like to add in, feel free. We'll see if folks are just spectating for the Saturday evening.
Hey, Gus, I just wanted to read the patent number for the coronavirus, just to don't let them tell you that this wasn't man-made. 101-307-01. And if you just type that in Google, it'll pull up this coronavirus, of course, made by the white supremacists. It was shocking, you know, because I heard someone who was at the actual court when this guy went before the judge, and the judge pretty much told him, like, I can't charge him with sexual assault. Talk about Odell Beckham, like, you know, this is it. But let's see what we could do. You know, it wasn't like, you know, just get out of here. It was, we're gonna find something we could charge him with. So, system of white supremacy.
Not be surprised if they don't, you know, try to charge him as well, or fine, charge, whatever, with him giving money to players. As I think I said last week, white people often get very serious about that type of thing. Like, oh my God, these are amateur athletes and you're sullying them, coming in with this dirty money. And like, man, just when they want to, if they decide, hey, you snapped him on the butt and today that's going to be sexual assault, you'll have to register as a sex offender. That might be what they decide today. System of racism, white supremacy. And it reminded me, Odell Beckham, that white woman said that he was reckless eyeballing her. Remember that? That was he still played for the Giants then. They had some party at the Met, and she said, oh yeah, he was looking at me like, oh, I don't want to have sex with her. What is she here for? She's like, what? What? And it was almost like he had to explain not wanting to reckless eyeball rape this white woman.
Anyway. I remember that, the Met Gala.
Mm-hmm, B-Cals, other folks, if you have comments, questions, contributions, number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, may I be heard? Hello?
We can hear you.
Thank you. My name is Kyra Rogue, and hello and greetings and respect and love to everyone listening. I just wanted to add a comment and with reference to black therapy in the system of racism and white supremacy, a personal experience. I was a caregiver for someone who was paralyzed and could not feel his legs, black man. And he was recently paralyzed and needed therapy. And a couple of things happened. We went to one therapist. As his caregiver, I was allowed to come into the sessions. One therapist decided that her best advice or thing to do was to have him listen to a meditation while she left the room, and I found her on the phone in another room, where he had to sit and meditate on feeling his toes and his legs and his ankles and his body parts that were numb. So right away, that was a trigger because he's paralyzed. Another experience, he told his truth to another white therapist, and who heard his story, and her reaction was to say, how do you live? And, you know, he tried it a few more times, and they tried to give him, you know, pills and whatever. And he decided, I'm not going to therapy because they're not listening to me. They can't even handle what I'm saying. So I just wanted to share that comment. Yeah, there is a big gap in, I can't say all white therapists, but the one that I have experienced, when they listen to black people tell their stories, their reactions are strange and unhelpful and disconnected completely. I want to say I did go to Gus T. Relegate, hi. I went to his yoga retreat in Florida, and had such an amazing healing experience. It was beyond anything I expected.
Oh, are you still there? Hello, hello. Are you still with us? Hello, hello. Uh-oh. Hello, hello. Are you still there? Not hearing you. Are you still there? Maybe we lost Kaya. Not hearing her. It looks like I am still connected. If you can hear me, we're not hearing you, Kaya. Lost you. You were talking about the retreat. Replenishing experience, and then it cut out. They didn't want you to do any more promoting, I guess. You dial back in. I'll see you all on the line. I was going to ask just to verify, she didn't have to smuggle in any sandwiches, bacon, chicken, potato chips, anything else. I think she survived. I don't think she came out looking famished. She went to see her mother after they hung out with us for the Florida retreat, and I don't think that she said her mother thought that she, you know, was about to starve or looked like she had been malnourished for the past week. In fact, I think she said she shared the sweet potato pie with mom and family as they continued to travel. So hopefully they'll get back on the line. I can add Kaya back, but thank you for sharing about the retreat. We should be in Toronto May 21 through May 24. The mental health out, that was so important as well. If I heard that correctly, I was going to ask to make sure to verify that this one of her family members, black male, he's talking about his experience, and she says, what was it? How do you live? How do you get up in the morning? I said, wow, I had that from Cheryl Judy's, people who can go back in the Cow's archives. That's what she said to me. Oh, I think we might have Kaya back here. I'm glad. Are you back with us, Kaya?
Well, yeah, I'm here.
Awesome.
Got you lost contact.
We lost you, I think, right at the point you said the retreat was replenishing. You had a great time. Is there more you were going to add?
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to add is when and everything was delicious in the menu. I don't know if you heard, but I was concerned that I was going to be hungry at night, and you know, I was so full and satiated. Everything was delicious, and there was one thing on the menu which I cannot stand: cooked carrots, and it was carrot hot dogs. And I thought, there's no way. What is this? Not possible. And it turned out to be one of my favorite dishes of the whole experience. They were delicious, and it didn't feel like I was eating a cooked carrot. Like, I felt like I was eating a hot dog without like the weird, greasy, disgusting part of a hot dog. It was like perfect. So I just wanted to add that and send love to everyone. And you know, yeah, thank you for listening.
So glad we got to add that. Chef Nadira's carrot hot dogs are legendary, times two. People said the exact same thing. She made those in Virginia, made the beginning. I said we sent out the menu in advance, so everybody, you get to see. It's not like, you know, it's a hidden thing, like you get there and we're going to spring it. Nope. Menu is available in advance. You can see all 3 days or 4 days, whatever it is. You get to see everything that we're going to be eating. If there's a concern, like something that you really don't like, you can say something. But again, carrots, I don't remember anybody going into the retreat saying, oh man, I like sweet potato pie or ice cream. Oh, that's great. But I mean, if you really want to hit my sweet spot, man, load my plate up with some carrots. That is what I didn't hear anybody say that before we got to the retreat.
Everyone.
And every time, without fail, man, those carrot hot dogs impress. I even made the carrot hot dogs once we got back. I took pictures of them. But yeah, I don't think anybody, I did not hear anyone ever at the retreat say, oh man, I was starved. I didn't get enough to eat. I went to bed, you know, hungry. I sure can't wait till we get the heck out of here. I'm going to stop and grab a sandwich as soon as I get 5 blocks away from the retreat. If I have to borrow, you know, money to get a ham sandwich or a loaf of bread off the highway. I didn't hear that from anybody. Everyone seemed like they ate really well, The food was great, and they were not in bed with their stomach growling at the counter-racist retreat. So food fears, that should be lowest on your list of worries. You can have concerns about, you know, lots of other things, getting through customs and all of that. Not, there should be no worries at all about Chef Nadira. Super verify. And we got pictures. Anybody that has messaged me with concerns about the food, I've also just sent the pictures. Like, I shouldn't have to say anything. Just whammo. You can see all the deliciousness for yourself. Let's see. Much obliged again, Kaya, Mr. Blue. We should have couples. So that again, seemingly turning into the Cows Counter-Racist Couples Retreat in Toronto. How about that? Other folks who dialed in, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Other folks, if we missed you totally, and or if we have folks with additional comments, suggestions they would like to add, feel free.
Yes, I just wanted to thank Miss Kaya again for the stone gift that she presented me with. I've been carrying that stone in my pocket ever since I've been back home. It's small enough to do so, and it's been a habit now of me carrying that stone in my pocket every day, and I kind of like Hamlet, whatever. That sort of thing. And so thanks again, Miss Kaya.
Hi. Oh, my God, that's so beautiful to hear. Thank you, Gus. You're such a blessing.
Fire, fire.
And Deshaun, Chef Nadira. We had such a blessed family bonding experience. And I'm going to add the good names. Can I say that? It was just... I still feel strong because I can do that now. Anyway, much love.
Much obliged again, Kaya, Mr. Blue. The retreat, lots of fun. Exchange views, had great food, went to the gun range twice in Florida. We did yoga every day. Same experience, or not the same, but... generally, you get the idea. Something constructive for victims of racism to relax, replenish. Hopefully you can share, store some of that up, take it with you after the retreat. Learning to replenish and relax is extremely important in a system that is designed to just have us constantly stressed and filled with toxins and bad food and stuck at McDonald's. The retreat is something totally different. Restoration, relaxation, eating some healthy vittles, healthy exchange of views. May 21 through May 24 in Toronto. Other folks, look at that. Young Academic might be with us as well. He was, actually, I can't just say he was with us in Florida, a retreat veteran. He would be one of the best people to ask, are you going to starve? Do you need to sneak in, you know, some treats and snacks to make sure that you'll survive if you're going to hang out with Gus T at the retreat? Because he was with us in Virginia. He battled the mud and then came back and was with us in Florida as well. Young Academic, good to hear from you again, sir.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Retreat was one of the best experiences of my life. I was full the entire time. No complaints about the food. Chef Nadira, food is delicious. Wonderful time. Great people. Great activities. Great conversation. Awesome time.
Much obliged. As I said, anyone, if you are concerned about the food, you can have concerns about, you know, having to be around Gus for 4 days. Legit. You can have concerns about crossing the border. Lots of things. The food, put that at the bottom of your list of concerns. Chef Nadira should be unquestioned at this point. I think everyone who's had her food, check out the pictures. You should be super taken care of. At least with the vittles. Other folks with questions, comments,
suggestions they would like to share, line should be open. Feel free. While folks are waiting, I think someone had mentioned the sexual abuse of children and how infrequently it is that they are prosecuted. And the pedophiles, the excuse that they'll give is, well, they don't get the treatment that they need because they would end up having to be in prison or some sort of punitive action as opposed to therapeutic action, I guess. Speaking of which, they just said there's supposed to be some sort of investigation with the New Orleans Saints. And I was confused. I had to stop and read to even grasp what I was looking at to make the connections here. But apparently, the New Orleans Saints football team, someone in the organization, oh, I think it was they had PR, right? You know, these are billion-dollar corporations founded on violence. So they got to have, like, extensive white people who are very skilled with words to call it their PR staff on how things are going to be presented in the media. We're not promoting brain damage. What are you talking about? We're about safety and taking care of colored people. Yeah. So they're apparently someone affiliated with the New Orleans Saints, I believe specifically their PR department, spoke to some of the Catholic priests who were accused of child rape, pedophiles, and is accused of, you know, trying to advise them on what to do, what was the best way to handle their situation so they won't get in any trouble for this child rape. And so this is somehow this ended up becoming big news. And they said, hey, we want an investigation. We want to see these emails. And the Saints organization said, oh, no, we're not giving up our emails. That's private business. And we didn't do anything wrong. We just had a little private conversation. You know, Louisiana's big Catholic area where all this happened. I don't know if they were in Louisiana or New Orleans specifically, but big Catholic area. So I can see the connection there. White people look out for other white people. So then this is going back and forth. And I think, you know, they might be going to court about these emails and whether or not the Saints have to divulge the goods. On what they said exactly, what they encouraged and that sort of thing. Just going back to child rape, I believe some idiot said around the time of Sandy Hook 2012, white people do not care about children. Lots of evidence of that, including the lack of effort to prosecute child rapists. But wow, the New Orleans Saints, after they spent all that time whining about playoff calls and this, that, and the other, and Drew Brees is the greatest, and that's what you're doing on your free time when you're not complaining that the referees robbed you is trying to help get child rapists off? Like, wow. That is the white team. Again, white people do not care. And they'll sit around and say football is a family game. We'll bring out all these 10 and 12-year-olds. They'll have Drew Brees. He's got like 20 children. They'll bring him out with his whole family, and we're about family. Yes, yes. And as soon as they turn the lights on, yes, now this is what to do. Make sure you get out there. Don't say child rape. That's an ugly one. Don't say that. Avoid the use of that term. See if you can go out and pose with some daycare facilities. What? Check out the only reason I didn't include it. We already had like an hour 10 worth of audio, but I certainly thought that was substantial. We have listeners in the Louisiana area. I don't know if folks thought of it or not, but I mean, Jerry Sandusky. I mentioned his name before. Jerry Sandusky. Not the only one, I'm sure. Other folks, comments, suggestions that they would like to add in.
Hey, Gus.
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, how are your iron levels since you went straight vegetables? Do you still get good iron?
I was concerned when I went vegan the first time when I lived in California. But the thing is, I think my nutrition is substantially better, period. Because before, I think when people think iron, that you're supposed to eat red meat, or at least people that I know that are not vegetarian, they're not vegan, it would be red meat consumption. And so they would think, oh, if you're not consuming red meat, where are you going to get your iron from? You would get much better quality, higher quality iron from green leafy vegetables. Spinach, I had Brussels sprouts today, but kale, almonds, all of those, apricots, all of those food items have substantial levels of iron. I have not had a problem with iron content, and now that I'm thinking about it, most of the people, black people that I have known that have had iron problems, they have not been vegetarian or vegan. They have been meat eaters, and they have terrible diet. They eat at McDonald's every day. They get all the red meat, but they're not getting like raw spinach, raw vegetables. They're not getting green leafy vegetables on a daily basis. It's not like they're eating raw almonds and apricots on a regular basis. Pumpkin seeds, that's another one that has a lot of iron in it. If you're not eating those type of foods, fruits and vegetables, those type of foods on a regular basis, then it doesn't really matter if you're vegan or not. Your iron, you might end up having iron problems, I think, especially for females, because that can be a problem for your time of the month. You're discharging more blood loss. But I have not had a problem with iron levels. I get a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables on a regular basis. I eat a lot of spinach, kale, fresh fruits, vegetables. That has not been, I think my iron levels are pre, and I take a multivitamin too. That was the other, Dr. Lathan, when she came on the program, said just to make sure to kind of touch your bases. I have a organic food-based multivitamin that has iron content in it as well, just to cover my bases, even though I feel like my food content probably takes care of things.
Okay.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Yes, yeah, so a report came out this week, I think it was in Zero Hedge, that more police officers killed themselves. And twice as many police officers killed themselves than they killed people in the line of duty. So I think if Blue Lives Matter, there'll be a rampant push to deal with police officers' mental health. I think they're 5 times more the national average to kill themselves than everyone else, which is even higher than soldiers now, which is pretty compelling. The CIA, and this is a question really for the firefighter. I sent him this article. The CIA Signature School is equipping firefighters with wearable emotional facial recognition devices. And I couldn't think for myself for the life of me, why would firefighters need facial recognition devices and with the emotion recognition software in it so it could tell if someone's sad or happy or in pain or whatever. Which they use in China to put it in the classrooms to tell if the kids are paying attention or if they're sleepy so they can pinpoint what kid needs the most help, what just system of learning. However, this for firefighters, I mean, I thought your job was to go in there and save people's lives, but you have to look at their faces, see which one needs to be saved the most. It's just found it kind of strange, especially since Amazon, who's the leader of facial recognition in the United States, brags that with their updates to their facial recognition technology, it now is 97% accurate on white people and a whopping 63% accurate on black people. So there's still a lot of error when it comes to identifying black people's faces. So I would imagine that same error would probably and with our emotions, we'll all be listed as angry black people or something. So I just thought that for firefighters to have this technology is very interesting. And the last thing was I've been watching, of course, they keep us inundated with the trial of the president, impeachment, which I don't see happening. However, Mr. Weinstein has been in court, Harvey Weinstein, and the defense attorney strategy that his defense attorneys are using is very interesting, where they're going after these white females, attacking their character, treating them like hostile witnesses, even though they're the victim, and total opposite of what Mr. Cosby did. His defense attorneys, they were very lenient on the white females. So, and of course, Mr. Cosby used black attorneys, which I probably would have advised against. But I wonder if that's a part of, you know, something that I guess white people could do. You know,
I just found that that was straight a little compelling, because I'm quite sure Mr. Cosby's black defense attorney attacked these white females' character, the news would have had a field day with, you know, ripping his attorneys and Mr. Cosby's defense strategy and everything else. So that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Retired firefighter, were you going to respond to the facial recognition component?
I don't have the slightest idea about that. I saw your report, but I didn't look at it yet. I saw the just the topic of it. I didn't look at it. But the only thing that I've ever had on my face is my self-contained breathing apparatus going into fires. And also you have to use it if you're going into some white people's homes, because the filthy smell that they have in their homes, you have to be breathing air from a tank. The smell is so horrendous. And also surgical masks. But the only thing that I can guess about it is children do not do well in describing what's wrong with them. And maybe in some kind of way that is to assist your facial expressions or whatever. Would assist the child into being a little bit more calm and in the intercommunication between your healthcare provider or emergency healthcare provider and the child. I haven't even read the article, but even after reading the article, because I've been retired for so long from that job, I wouldn't have the slightest idea of what is coming up with that particular tool.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Thomas in New York. I'm not really sure. I do know firefighters are called out for a substantial number of different calls, like emergency response. It could be medical response types of things as well. So if you responded to a person, if it's a medical call, you can't identify the person. They don't have a wallet on them, maybe, right? They could say that might be legit, then you can get that person's medical file maybe, or if they have medical or any sort of medical history, this sort of thing has happened before, drug history, that information might be available once you can identify the person through facial recognition technology. But in a system of white supremacy, I could also see where you would just want this type of surveillance material available. If you want to keep tabs on the plantation, I could see that. You would just have emergency responders of all sorts would have this material available. Let's see. Other folks, did you have suggestions, comments, questions? Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to join us. Other folks have comments?
Very, very, very last thing, Gus, I promise you. Activism. I would say that if you're in a group, a black activist group that was formed on Facebook or with a hashtag like Me Too or Black Lives Matter, ADOS, all these hashtag groups, I would probably say that the chances of it being surveilled is very high, much higher than if you don't have it online. Or, you know, and that's even very high. They could infiltrate anything, but you're giving them all your information, then it's easy for them. They could just go through your friends list, pick out your friends. They know your family. They know your habits. I mean,
It's just I would stay away from social media with these type of groups. And also study Hong Kong. They've been protesting for almost a year. They're under Serene facial recognition technology, a suppressive government that will come back and arrest them later for things that they did. I mean, it's pretty much what's going to be happening here, and see how they're countering the surveillance. And it's pretty compelling, some of the methods they're using, from umbrellas to making paper masks, a whole bunch of things, putting lights on their hats because at nighttime, the camera, if you put a light on your hat, it'll block out an infrared camera. So you'll just have a big light in front of the face. You'll see the body, but not the face. There's a whole bunch of tactics that they're using. Peru, in fact, all around this world right now, massive protests, except for here. And the government is not showing, whether the media is not putting it on television. But I'm talking about Peru, Iran, the protests are massive all throughout the Middle East, in Africa as well. There's massive protests in certain areas that they're just not putting on. And these people are fighting against this surveillance that they're encountering. Just the other day in Morocco, they arrested people for things that they posted online, like things that were anti-government and things. So, you know, it's coming to that. So just be very careful joining a group that started on Facebook with no leader, with no, I wouldn't join a group with a, you know, but either way, you have no person that's in charge of this group. It's, you don't know, white people could have started the group and just found some black people to play the part as the leaders. You have to be very careful.
Of white supremacy. Dr. Cambon said delete your social media account. At least have lots of caution. Other folks, questions, comments, suggestions they would like to offer? I think I got all of our hands. We'll give folks about 5 minutes. Not hanging out if they're just going to spectate on a Saturday evening. You'll have to check Black Talk Radio Network. We have a black author and a white author coming on the program. You'll get the exact times, dates. Just check the Facebook page, Black Talk Radio Network page, for the updates. Reading more important than watching television. We actually had a retired correctional officer who wrote a book about his experience, non-white male. Looking forward to getting into some of the details. Thinking Delectable Negro. Other comments, suggestions, folks wanted to make sure they get in. Grant, I'll check in one more time before we get ready to sign out for the retreat, May 21 through May 24. Let me know if you have questions, need additional information. The information is posted at the blog post, but if something was missed or you just need additional clarification, drop an email, not via social media. Drop an email. That is the best way if you would like information, details addressed. If you just have something that you want to make sure, if you're not totally certain about, make sure that you have all of the accurate info. UntilJustice@gmail.com. The iTunes feed, I think, is still not working correctly. The compensatory call-in from last week, I am going to post that once we get off the air for today, but I still think there's a problem with the feed, at least for some people, where like a pro, it'll play like 5 minutes. And that's it. And then it won't continue for the rest of the program, even though the entire archive has been uploaded. That is beyond my control. But people should not feel exclusively tied to iTunes. Put it that way. there is, let's see, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Black Talk Radio Network, Google Play, among a plethora of other outlets where you should be able to stream online and or download the content. I know that the iTunes feed is more convenient for some folks. I get it. Hopefully it will return to working correctly. But again, that is beyond my control. But I do make an effort to make sure that the content is easily available at other sites. So it's not like that is the only location that you can depend on to access the content. And again, I would encourage folks, drop iTunes an email about why the feed is not working. I have emailed them before. Sometimes that has worked. It seems pretty shortly after I emailed them, it started working again. Sometimes it doesn't. Might have an impact if, you know, 5 or 20 listeners email them as well. Anywho, check the update for upcoming programs, Black Author, White Author, Reading, More Important Than Watching Television. Check in one more time. Any other folks that we missed, comments, questions, they want to make sure they get in? I will assume everybody is satisfied for the evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We want to do everything we can to preserve our brain computers, eating well, sleeping correctly as best we can. We are reading A Terrible Thing to Waste, all about the attack against our brain computer. Harriet A. Washington includes in that noxious alcohol. Even had our listener in Chicago. He was talking about the cannabis legalization. He said, I view that as a part of chemical and biological warfare. Henry in Chicago just said that this week. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver, doing everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being sober and buckled up, if you're driving, you are not on the cell phone at all, doing the little things to stay away from the Daniel Holtzclaws, Amber Geigers of the known universe. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.